D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Katrin Ohlendorf. Heute Poverty, Inequality and Food von Sir James Alexander Mirrlees. Mehr als 1 Milliarde Menschen leben weltweit in extremer Armut. Extreme Armut, das bedeutet laut Weltbank, pro Tag weniger als 1 US-$25 Einkommen zu haben. Egal, ob man nun diese Definition für geeignet hält, Armut zu messen oder nicht, Fakt ist, mehr als 1 Milliarde, also sage und schreibe über 1.000 Millionen Menschen, müssen dauerhaft Tag für Tag um ihr Überleben kämpfen. Seit den 90er Jahren hat sich diese Zahl zwar deutlich verringert, allerdings nicht gleichmäßig in allen Erdregionen. In vielen Teilen Afrikas zum Beispiel hat sich die Situation seither verschlimmert, während in asiatischen Ländern, allen voran China, deutliche Verbesserungen zu beobachten sind. Woran liegt das? Lassen sich Mechanismen in diesen Ländern auf andere übertragen? Beziehungsweise generell, wie kann man Armut mindern? Mit dieser Frage befasst sich der heutige Hörsaalvortrag des Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträgers Sir James Alexander Mirrlees. Mirrlees wurde 1936 in Schottland geboren. Er studierte zunächst Mathematik und Philosophie an der Edinburgh University und am Trinity College der Cambridge University, wo er 1963 dann in Wirtschaftswissenschaften promovierte. Seine akademische Laufbahn brachte ihn unter anderem ans MIT nach Oxford, Yale und Cambridge sowie an eine Zahl von Instituten in Asien, etwa nach Neu-Delhi, Islamabad oder Hongkong. Dort wirkt er heute, neben anderen Tätigkeiten, als Master des Morningside College der Chinese University of Hong Kong. Den Nobelpreis für Ökonomie erhielt er 1996 gemeinsam mit dem kanadischen Wirtschaftswissenschaftler William Vickrey für die ökonomischen Modelle und Gleichungen, die er in seiner Oxford-Zeit erarbeitet hatte. Geehrt wurden die beiden insbesondere, Zitat, für ihre grundlegenden Beiträge zur ökonomischen Theorie über Anreiz bei asymmetrischer Information. Sein Modell zur Analyse von Entscheidungssituationen mit unvollständiger oder asymmetrischer Information wurde zur Standardmethode für die Untersuchung entsprechender Fälle. Im heutigen Vortrag, den er am 25. August 2011 im Rahmen des 4. Lindauer Wirtschafts-Nobelpreisträgertreffens gehalten hat, erläutert James Mirrlees am Beispiel Chinas bzw. in Abgrenzung zum chinesischen Modell, wie Armut, Ungleichheit und Ernährung zusammenhängen und wie sich Armut reduzieren ließe. Auf unserer Homepage wissen.deradio.de finden Sie übrigens auch einen Link zum Video des Vortrags und weitere Informationen zu Mirrlees.
I've been interested in development issues for a very long time. What I'm going to be doing today is making some quite small points in a way, but they're small points about very important issues that have to do with reducing poverty. And it was suggested to me by, it's a kind of reaction to things that I've seen in the press and heard in general conversation. Let's start to make sure that you understand what's going on here. Of course, poverty is one of those words that is really incredibly vague, indefinable. Possibly you think this is some kind of idea of what is the least you need in order to live satisfactorily at all. But of course, if you actually try to calculate the cost of the necessary food to keep alive with a decent expectation of health, then that is incredibly cheap. Really, one has to include a lot of things besides basic food, but you saw food in the title of the talk. So, of course, I'm thinking of food particularly. But if we're going to get any kind of measurement of somebody's standard of living and relate it to a notion of poverty, we'd better measure real consumption in some sense, and it had better include things like education, health care, and other very important publicly provided infrastructure. Even then, of course, it's still crude. You can't really capture this in a single-dimensional number. But having got there, you wonder what we should do about this inequality of consumption, which, of course, is revealed as soon as you start getting measures of this kind. And that's really the topic of this talk. And I'm going to be reacting a bit to what is the standard way of presenting the poverty, which is to concentrate very much on the crudest possible description of the inequality of consumption that we know exists by showing poverty headcounts. Poverty headcounts, of course, are simply the number of people below some almost arbitrarily chosen number for real consumption. And quite often when you see poverty headcounts, they're based on surveys that have estimated income, and they may not even be income per capita. And if they're consumption, they might not be consumption per capita, but consumption per household. And it can sometimes be a little tricky to track down which. But I don't want to use alternative kinds of measures like Gini coefficients, because they pay just as much attention to what's going on in the upper part of the income distribution or consumption distribution as in the lower. Hence, I concentrate on that. And this is where we had got to. You may well wonder, or you may well conjecture, that the reason why this stops in 2005 is because I was too lazy to bring it up to date. But actually, if you get onto the World Bank figures on the web, you'll find that 2005 is the last year when you have very many fairly well-established figures for a decent number of countries. Of course, you can get later figures, particularly for higher-income countries, and a few scattered figures, 2006, 2007. But the standard measure is what we've got here, and I dare say we'll quite soon get some later figures. So I'll remind you of the dramatic feature of economic history, that the number of people living below a fixed real poverty line of $1.25 a day has gone down very substantially in this period of 15 years, and it's been going down somewhat more rapidly in the more recent period. And of course, you can see from this graph that that's largely what happened in Asia, in East Asia, which is to say that China made a very large contribution to this. And I just remind you that through this period, world population was growing at slightly over 1% a year, or a bit more than that. So actually, as a proportion, poverty has been going down quite well. But there's what happened in China, which has been the really dramatic effect. So I'm going to start by saying a little bit about why I think, or how I think, China managed to achieve, if it is an achievement, because maybe it just happened rather than was planned as such, to do something quite this dramatic. I don't know that anybody particularly believes in the 1980 figure, which with this tremendously high proportion below that, because certainly at that time, China was using a poverty level way below $1.25 a day for its own official measures, and the surveys were perhaps not terribly well conducted then. But in the more recent 20 years, I don't think there's much question that they've been fairly well done. And it makes it look as though there isn't any poverty probably in China now, if you could properly project this curve forward. I know when I suggested to the Department of Chinese government, informally over coffee, that looking at this graph, it appeared they should close down the office. That they immediately said there's a lot of poverty in China. I don't know whether you regard that as clear evidence. What I want to do is to talk a little bit now about how China reduced it, at least this is what I think. First thing to say is that this is not only by official figures, it seems to be pretty much verified by the very careful consumer surveys that have been done, that poverty in this sense is mainly rural. of course, there are some poor people in cities, but numerically, it appears not to be a very large figure. So therefore, what we have to consider is what has happened there. Now, the Chinese strategy for economic growth was quite deliberately to industrialize and to encourage urban expansion, to get into export growth, which was expected to be largely exports of urban-produced goods. And that has pretty much been what has happened. And you might therefore think that if indeed poverty declined, and that means that rural poverty declined tremendously, that this just happened and it wasn't particularly an outcome of that strategy. But of course, there was migration into industry. I put it this way, into industry in urban areas. I put it this way because there was quite a lot of industry in towns and even villages. Not so important nowadays, but in the 80s that would have been quite important. Quite a lot of people, therefore, were drawn into industry, and when in industry, they were paid a wage that was above the poverty line. So clearly this makes some contribution. But it wouldn't be unrealistic to say that the typical example is of somebody living in a rural area, which is perhaps rather above the average standard of living. There's a great deal of inequality between villages, if I can put it that way, for reasons that I will come to in a couple of lines. And of course, it's the people in the better-off villages who actually are more likely to be able to work well in the cities, and they're more likely to migrate and can afford the costs that are associated with migration. Migration, which is often temporary for a number of years rather than completely permanent. So what you're seeing is people being lifted from an income level which may already be above the poverty line to an income level that is typically about three times the income that they have been receiving in rural areas. The one way of looking at that is to say that's a really pretty expensive way of reducing poverty. Of course, there are some reasons for that, some good, some not so good. Another contribution that we made to reducing poverty is the one-child policy, which has meant that population has grown rather more slowly in China than it otherwise would have. The population is still growing. It is expected to peak in about 10 years, and even if the one-child policy were now greatly weakened, that would still be true. Of course, that means that if output is not too sensitive to the number of people in rural areas are actually producing, that you'd expect income per head in rural areas to be a bit higher as a result of that. And rough calculations confirm that that's pretty much true. What one might expect, what I had naively thought before I looked into things properly, was that this very special feature of China might be a major reason why poverty was now quite low. Namely that the use of land is distributed equally to people in the village. Men, rather. That statement covers a variety of ways of doing it. And there is still cases of common land being used in common and things like that. But broadly that's right. So that unlike many countries, many poor countries, you don't have land ownership in the hands of landowners who are quite rich, for example. Another way of putting it is to say that the income of people in agriculture in rural areas in China is made up of an implicit wage and also implicit rent, because they don't have to pay any rent for the land they get the use of. In theory, they don't own the land. They're not allowed to borrow on it as security. Sometimes what is effectively selling of land takes place, but that's irrelevant to the point that I'm making now, that at least one of the major reasons why you'd expect considerable inequality in rural incomes is simply not present in China. On the other hand, as I remarked before, as between villages, you get very great differences. And because of what's called the hukou system, the registration system for where people live, the people cannot easily move from village to village. In fact, I'm told by some people that it just can't happen. Therefore, you don't get equalization between villages and provinces, and that in itself is clearly a major reason for continuing inequality. However, the reason why I say that I put the question mark here and say land distribution isn't what's doing it is that the land had been redistributed long before the beginning of what's called the reform period, which is the period that I'm really looking at and the period that these inequality and poverty figures refer to, starting in 1978 or 9. So that you wouldn't expect any change in the poverty levels to be associated with this relatively satisfactory land distribution. But it seems to me, in looking into it, that it comes down to agricultural growth in China. Now, as you'd probably guess by now, at least, I think the proportion of people living in rural areas working in agriculture, or the proportion of working hours in agriculture, is probably less than a half. So that one shouldn't think of incomes in rural areas as being entirely generated by agriculture. Indeed, incomes as such are only a part of the total incomes. But many of the other incomes, the services associated with it, services of distribution, of carting things by lorry from one place to another, all of the usual services that grow up as people get richer, are based on agriculture in some fundamental sense. The real source of growth you can see like this. This is my calculation of agricultural value added in China. It happens not to be per capita, but the number of people working in agriculture had not been growing very fast and has now been declining for some years. So this gives you a pretty good indication of incomes per head in agriculture as well as elsewhere. Now, of course, as the income per head goes up in agriculture, so the wage for other activities in rural areas goes up as well. So this then gets into the general incomes in rural areas. Now, that's a pretty impressive growth rate. It's nearly quadrupled in the 30 years that this picture refers to. But that's as nothing compared to the growth rate of the economy as a whole, as measured by GDP, or even GDP per head. So I must say, I think this probably gives a better indication of the growth of people's enjoyment of life, or standard of living, than the headline growth figures that we hear of so frequently. This is probably a more realistic one. It's, I remember right, it's around 5% a year. And in many ways, that's what it takes to get so many people out of poverty, because the distribution of income around this, the average that's implied by the diagram, is of course quite dispersed, but the whole distribution moves upwards over time, like this. And of course, the number of people in the lower tail, below the $1.25 a day level, which started off as a very high proportion, then falls. And by the way, you can see that this fairly rapid growth in the average towards the end may well have to do with the way the distribution is moving up, and that the lower tail no longer matters so much.
Sie sind im D-Radio-Wissen-Hörsaal und hören in unserer Lindau-Reihe den Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger Sir James Alexander Mirrlees zum Thema Armut, Ungleichheit und Ernährung. Diesen Vortrag hat Mirrlees am 25. August 2011 gehalten, und zwar im Rahmen des 4. Lindauer Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträgertreffens.
D-Radio-Wissen, Hörsaal, rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
My notion is that quite a lot of the reduction in poverty can be put down to that. And how did that come about? When you look at the various inputs into agriculture, labor input not been increasing, irrigation, the irrigated land had gone up by about 50% in this period. And fertilizer use had rocketed up. And it looks very clear that this is the Green Revolution at work. The coming of the new varieties, which was, even began in the early 60s, late 50s, but really exploded in China in this period, and allow crops to use very large quantities of chemical fertilizers, which of course are industrial products. So it's very important that they were available, and there were fertilizer subsidies that encouraged the use of land, and there were considerable improvements in transportation facilities, which meant that cash crops could be more useful and get a better price. So all of these things were there encouraging this growth. The availability of the fertilizers, which was possible because of the, essentially because of export earnings by industry initially, and later by the actual production of them. Now, that's one way of looking at the importance of agriculture and the reduction of poverty. And you notice that it's just a simple, straightforward view of it as generating income. And that's not how most non-economists, at least, tend to think about this. They think to deal with poverty, the important thing is the production of food. Recently, we'd had an FAO statement, which I got off the web. By mid-2008, international food prices had skyrocketed to their highest level in 30 years. This, coupled with the global economic downturn, pushed millions more people into poverty and hunger. Now, of course, they don't say how much of that is supposed to be the result of the global economic downturn, but this is FAO, so they really mean that it was mainly the rise in prices that did that. They're quite explicit after this bit I've quoted in saying that their view of the problem with food prices was influenced by reports from countries who were asked to each estimate how much they thought poverty would have changed as a result, and many stories of riots, which I draw your attention to the fact that they were urban. Point about them being urban is, of course, that workers in the cities certainly are made worse off by rising prices if they're not compensated by higher wages, higher price of food. But that's not true of people who are net producers of food. So I'd advise some skepticism to this, and I want to explore it a little further. Higher prices for food might well have brought millions out of poverty. If you have a very small farm and you're struggling and have to sell some of the food in order to pay for the other necessities of life, then higher prices for food grains are just what you want. And we should bear in mind that that may well be important. And I think there's no question that in China that was very important, because in the most recent years you get high value added because of higher prices. Just what happened to prices? Well, I hope that's reasonably visible. Indeed, you should read right from the bottom of the blue of the background of the graph, because that's roughly at the zero level. It's actually slightly positive. But even allowing that the diagram may be a little misleading, that there were big jumps. I'm happy to be able to say that in 2008, just when the prices had gone up like mad, I was giving a lecture where I said, I'm sure they will come down. You should not regard this as a new inflation in prices. And they did. But I didn't realize that they were going to jump up again, and they have done that. Although, more recently, you can see on the left-hand graph here that admittedly now we've gone high again. They came down a bit through 2010, and now they're in the most recent figures from the FAO. They're at the highest level. And I want you to compare that with what you see on the right-hand graph, if you can see that at all clearly. The things I'm interested in here are the green line and the orange line. The orange line is production, best estimate one can get, and it does fluctuate rather a lot. I just emphasize that the horizontal axis is at 1800, so we're not measuring up from zero, of course, and the top level there is 2300. Now, this is, of course, quite a considerable growth. But if you look at utilization, which is the actual use, and the reason why the two are different is, of course, that you get inventory, the stocks change, that the green line is remarkably smooth. So you're getting considerable fluctuations in prices, as reported, while you're getting fairly smooth change in actual demand as it comes out. What that, of course, very strongly suggests is that in the food market, there's a great deal of sensitivity of prices to relatively small changes in the balance between demand and supply. Although, strangely, for a very long period, food prices remained remarkably stable, food grain prices at least. And I don't quite know why that should have been true when more recently they've started to go tumbling around. Speculation may have something to do with it, but that doesn't show up all that clearly in the stock figures that we have here. That's background to how important is food in all this. And the lesson I was drawing there was the sensitivity of food prices to small changes. And hark that back to me pointing out that there's at least a belief that these changes in food prices could have a rather big impact on poverty. So that doesn't necessarily mean we can do anything about the whole thing, but that we may want to pay attention to that. And one of the things that we might draw from this is that the China story may not be something to be applied to the rest of the world very much. That's to say that we shouldn't necessarily expect that somehow poverty can be put right by relying on the agricultural sector. Particularly in Africa, that might not be the way, and certainly Africa's been having most of the time rather a bad time in agriculture. What's the alternative? The classic way of dealing with poverty or low incomes or inequality is transfers. You might reasonably have guessed that whatever topic I'd taken, I'd come round to taxes and subsidies sooner or later. And it seems to me to make a great deal of sense in the area of poverty. So I want to explore just what the chances are of doing a good job of reducing poverty by transfers. These are already used. Cash transfers are used in Latin America, Mexico, and Brazil, at least. And India has rather equivalent things like employment schemes and free school meals. So these would count and is considering other possibilities. There are also things like the World Food Programme, which distributes food to particularly needy areas, not simply on an emergency basis, because, for example, East Timor has had a steady flow of food from the World Food Programme for quite a number of years, simply an important part of their income, in effect. So transfers can certainly be used. How good do they work? Well, there isn't a lot of time to do this. It's a bit difficult to find out quite what the demand for function for food is, but we really need to have it in order to do a good assessment. So I'll skip over this fairly quickly, but as you could understand, even although prices fluctuate quite a bit, it's difficult that for long periods they really hadn't done so much, and therefore it's been hard to get at the price response. So I think most people guess at a demand function that treats the demand for food as a function of income divided by food price. And that actually fits pretty well to data, but not if it's a linear function. Deaton and Subramanian found that the elasticity demand was falling. And within the range they were looking at for, I think it was Maharashtra, it got down to 0.4, and for higher incomes, I'm sure it's much less than that, and presumably one at zero. Now, this is all important because it means that low-income people are going to change their purchase of food much more as price changes or income changes than high-income people. And the question is, what does that imply? Well, look at what happens if you said about redistributing from, say, a bunch of rich people in order to pay poor people. Modeling this the supply of goods fixed is convenient. You've got to do something that will reduce the demand for food by the rich, because otherwise there won't be extra food for the poor to have, and the only way that the poor's standard of living can increase is if there's quite a lot of food, at least at the very bottom. It turns out, with the kind of demand function I was describing, that the price of food will rise if you do this. And in fact, it can rise quite a lot. Now, you may say, that would only be true if you had an enclosed food market within the country. Don't countries trade with one another? Well, much less than you'd expect, actually. Of course, the richer countries do quite a lot of trade in food grains. But one of the reasons for these fluctuations in food grain prices is because of the countries that greatly restrict trade, international trade. So the internal price is probably quite important in practice. And there are several conclusions I want to get from this. One is that a successful transfer system is going to be associated with a rise in food prices. That doesn't exactly mean that if you see food prices have gone up, you should applaud, but it suggests that that may be important. Second point, however, is that many of the poor may not be food producers at all, and that they may indeed suffer quite a lot from the consequential rise in food prices, so it's necessary that the transfer they receive, the amount of income paid to them, is big enough to more than compensate for the effects of the rising price. Doesn't apply to food grain producing farmers, but it does in another way. We don't apply that to the landlords, who may do very well from a higher food price, but they have to be taxed. And there's another issue. It comes back to these urban riots, which is, of course, if indeed the process would necessarily mean a rise in prices, then you should think about the impact on others besides those that you've particularly focused on in creating the transfer system. I suggest that the sensible way of doing this is that the transfer system should compensate the middle to lower income people. I'm thinking of them essentially as the urban wage earners, so that they are not worse off and so that they don't start rioting and complaint. Of course, that means that you're going to have to take more from the rich in order to achieve any particular improvement of poverty at the lower end. But what I'm after here is that it's actually quite important to design these transfer systems and paying attention to other people in the population besides those that you think of as being particularly targeted by it. And the last point would be, if you accept that for poor people who are not food producers, that you want an increase in income, and that must at least cover costs that arises from the increased price of food, then good delivery control matters, because if a lot of that were to evaporate through corruption and fraud, then you'd very quickly find that there was a net loss for many of the poor people rather than a net gain. And I think that's a concern in practically every country. Thank you very much.
Sie hörten den Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger Sir James Alexander Mirrlees mit seinem Vortrag Poverty, Inequality and Food. Der Vortrag war Teil des 4. Lindauer Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträgertreffens und wurde am 25. August 2011 aufgezeichnet.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.